Very good morning to everyone. My name is Xu Yong from ABS. I think we had a very good morning first panel session, who has set the tone. So today's on our panel session is on energy transitions and on alternative fuels. Energy transition, as what the first panel has also mentioned, is a very crucial topic in today's world. And as we navigate the challenges of the climate change and also the sustainable development, and alternative fuels plays an important role in these transitions, offering promising solutions to reduce carbon emissions. But today, at the same time, we also do not foresee that fossil fuels will go away. But with me today, we have a very good distinguished panel of experts which will share their insights and also the perspective of this important subject or topics that we are actually on talking about. So let me first introduce our panelists. We have Ms. Dorothy, Chief Executive Officer from American P&I Club, Mr. Mark Cameron, Managing Director for Ardmore Shipping, Mr. Danny Goldsmith, from Senior Manager from Enterprise Marine Systems, Chevron, Mr. Andrew Hawk, Head of Fortescue Marine Systems, and Ms. Federica, Co-Founder and Managing Director of 044. As shipping is moving into a new era, so if I could let each panelist to share briefly your experience and expertise in this energy transitions period, and what is your organization evolving, and how is it performing, and what are the key drivers behind on the decisions that has been made from your organization. Maybe we start with Dorothy.
Sure, thank you. Is this on? Can I be heard? Okay. From the American P&I Club perspective, obviously we are very concerned with liabilities. Our job is to assess and evaluate risk and then underwrite that risk. But beyond that, really, if you think about it, looking at the group of P&I clubs, the international group, we basically enable trade because with the evidence of security from a certificate from one of the clubs, obviously the ships are free to trade throughout the world. And within that infrastructure, really, we are the supporters of progress and we are the supporters of technological advancement. So to a certain extent, without the infrastructure of the international group, there could be no green transition, if you ask me. So I think that's the core of it.
Thanks, Dorothy. How about Mark?
Yeah, thanks. By way of background, I'm a chief engineer. I was one of those people who spent my time at sea, and I've been ashore for way longer than I was ever at sea. My biggest challenge is staying current, to really try and understand the technical expectations of technologies that we're putting on board, the educational process that we're putting our captains and chief engineers through, and trying to also understand and distinguish the difference in claims that are made by providers and boiling it down to my specific application. That's complicated, and that takes up an enormous amount of time. And then you layer on top of that, of course, safety concerns. But when you talk to chief engineers and captains on board the ship, we're asking a fundamentally different expectation of them than what they were trained for all the years ago that they were. And that's changing in the way that between a captain and a chief engineer, what we expect of them when it comes to prosecuting a voyage. And if you look at charter party terms and proceed with utmost dispatch and, you know, sort of all the language that we use from probably not more than the 1800s, I think it's really time that the chartering language was updated, that the language between a captain and chief engineer and the expectations we have of them in conducting their roles changes as well, that we truly understand that. So that's sort of a little bit of the background for me.
Thanks, Mark. How about Danny from Chevron?
Yeah, thanks. Well, firstly, thanks to Capital Links for the invitation to participate on the panel. I think we've got a great team here. We're going to talk through this pretty complicated issue that we've got. But my role at Chevron is the Enterprise Marine Strategy Manager, and essentially that is to look at the fuels, lubricants, and additives that we need to produce as a company to support our marine customers in the energy future. And Chevron's one of the largest energy majors in the world. We operate in around 75 countries. We do supply energy, but we also are a ship owner and a ship operator. So we typically have around 150 ships on charter at any one time, and we own and operate 30 vessels. Chevron believes the future of energy is a lower carbon future, and our differentiated energy transition policy is to lower the carbon intensity of our current business, so our current assets, but also grow lower carbon businesses in renewable fuels and products such as hydrogen and the derivatives. We have a business focusing on the energy future called Chevron New Energies, and it has three pillars. One is under hydrogen and derivatives, carbon capture, utilization and storage, and an offsets and emerging business. So looking forward to the discussion today.
Thanks, Danny. How about Andrew from your side?
Likewise, thank you very much for this opportunity today to be part of this panel. I work for Fortescue Group. We're a global green technology, mining and energy company. I think we're recognized for our culture of innovation, delivering very large infrastructure projects, traditionally in the mines, and most recently we're being renowned for delivering those on the green energy and on the water as well. We have two principal divisions, so an energies division and a metals division. I think we're one of the first companies in the world to have achieved FID in the hydrogen space. One is for the production of hydrogen in the US, and the other is for the production of PEM electrolyzers in Australia. So a truly incredible journey from a group that set out as a mining group. We have very ambitious plans to eliminate our Scope 1 and 2 terrestrial emissions by 2030. I think that puts us at the head of any organization on the planet of our scale. We also have an intention to eliminate our Scope 3 by 2040. So really, we want to be the world's number one green technology company. We want to continue to remain a low-cost provider of iron ore and products to our customers, and we want to profitably reduce the emissions from our supply chain. And just one little thing to add, bring it slightly back to shipping as well. We have the Green Pioneer is a ship that you will see off the coast of Singapore for the last couple of months, now in Keppel Bay. She is the world's first ammonia-capable, ammonia-powered ship that has full class accreditation and flag accreditation as well, and she has burned ammonia, and she will continue to burn ammonia as our prototype ship. So we very much believe in the power of now. We have done stuff today. We can do stuff today to accelerate the transition.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Friederike Hesse. I'm the co-founder and managing director of 044. We are not dealing with the technology of the ship, but we are really helping with managing those market-based measures that were mentioned in the previous panel, because they are important enablers to make sustainable fuels more price attractive. But they come with a downside. They are mostly very complicated, and they are not global yet. So what we are trying to help with is providing software that helps the onshore teams steer their business through this transition period, where things like FuelEU Maritime make life much more complicated, and the optimization challenge across regulations when you have to take CII, EU ETS, FuelEU Maritime and future regulations into account when you fix your next voyage charter, that's really our playing field with our software.
Thanks, Federica. Well, I think it's very interesting to hear the extreme insights of the panelists, what your organization is doing, what is moving forward and evolving on the next couple of years with regards to these energy transitions. So maybe on the next question is, I want to direct maybe to Mark yourself, you know, being a ship owner, you know, what are the economic implications and also the transformations or the transition during this energy period in terms of selecting alternative fuels? What are you looking at? And what is the strategy behind it?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, you know, you've got to stay current, and that's complicated. So you've got to be a little bit of a chemist as well as sort of an engineer. And I think one of the things that we've done at Ardmore, and bear in mind we operate tankers, so we move liquid bulk, and we certainly believe that we'll continue to move liquid bulk in the future, probably just maybe in different forms and with different customers, but liquid bulk will be around for a long time, and with that, the reciprocating engine will be around for a long time. We have, however, invested in a methanol reformer business to try and understand that this slippery little molecule called hydrogen that everybody is in pursuit of is a really complicated structure, and it's complicated to try and get it into an engine, as Andrew is telling you about there with his vessel, and he's got direct experience of this. This isn't easy. So what we've been doing is working with and partnering really with industry to try and find investments that we can make and technologies that we can really try and understand. But I think we sometimes lose sight. We always go for the end goal in our industry. We're always there to say, okay, well, what's the main engine going to burn? Well, the generators on board ships are going to lead the way for us. And I think we sometimes forget that the answers are in incremental steps. And we believe that electrical production on board will be the first step to be revitalized in a big two-stroke engine environment where you're talking about the main propulsion being a very different type of engine. So a fundamental step to change the fuel on board, first of all, to produce electricity for household use or hotel load, and then to look at further ways that your main engine can be enhanced. Now, all the guys before talked about fantastic technologies that are being used, and I think, by and large, all of us are using pretty much the same technologies. But there is a difference that we're doing now where we're locking in ships to operate on a power basis. You know, speed control for your car controls the speed. Power control on board a ship controls the emissions. And that means your speed varies. And if your speed's going to vary, your ETA should be allowed to shift within a reasonable range. And we need the entire supply chain, we believe, to be in on this together. That includes charterers, operators, engineers on board the ships to understand what a power management system really looks like.
Thanks, Mark. I think it's a very good, interesting point that you have pointed out. I think with regards to the whole ecosystems that's involved in installing all these energy efficiency technologies and also a device, you know, and what are the selections of the alternative fuels that you have mentioned, which is hydrogen, moving forward is as part of the alternative fuels in this market. I think next I will actually touch on to Andrew. I guess just as you mentioned about your vessel, the Green Pioneer, you know, which is public news. I mean, it was mentioned in yesterday's opening ceremony on the SMW with regards to the first use of ammonia. So what maybe you can share a bit of your experience or what is the decision behind in terms of choosing ammonia so and so far moving forward for these vessels? Yeah.
Well, I guess, you know, first of all, I think we take the view that the industry has been complacent for a long, long time. We've accepted that the oil, the fuel oil, the bottom of the barrel, the low-hanging fruit has been an acceptable fuel for a long period of time. It's only just in the last few years that we've realized, oh, maybe there are some problems with this fuel. And I think this is the concern. There's been a complete lack of innovation. The last big innovation in shipping was when we moved from whale oil to fuel oil in sort of the early 1900s. And I think, you know, Singapore was made because they created air conditioning. That was a massive innovation. Now, we fully respect, because we operate ships as well, the incremental measures that are taking place today. But one of the challenges that we need to address, and we heard it from the earlier panel, we need to make sure that the fuel that we expect to be ready for, that we're making ourselves ready for, is available in the 2 to 3 years' time when the ships are going to be delivering, where we're going to need that fuel. So we can do all the analysis and technological sort of examination today and then decide 4 or 5 years' time, okay, yes, it's going to be ammonia or whatever else. But then it's too late. So the purpose of us doing this Green Pioneer project was to show actually that there's actually no new technology required. There is just a Northern Star to say that we have to move away, but there are enormous hurdles to doing so. The hurdles are regulatory. There are no rules. There's no rule book. The hurdles are people and training and so forth. But if we don't start this journey today, if we wait for the final sort of academic reports to be finished in 2, 3, 4 years' time, it's too late. We shift everything back, and then we won't meet those 1.5% degree targets that we want to meet. I think if this room was filled with, you know, people who live in low-lying areas, they would agree that we do have to start this movement today. So I think what we've done as a group, we've focused on our own technologies within the mines. We're putting a lot of battery electric type technology into the equipment there to make sure that we just begin to cut our own emissions, fuel trucks, mining trucks, excavators, and so forth. And then also from the production of ammonia as well. You know, we're going to be producing, you know, we're fast-tracking FIDs in Brazil, a facility in Pecém. We're fast-tracking in Norway, 2 projects there, and also Australia as well. So Australia will supply the, you know, Asia markets with the renewable fuel. In our case, we believe it should be ammonia. You know, they were the rest of the Brazilian markets and Norwegian markets will supply Europe as well with that fuel. So we have to think of everything, and we are, as a group, we are trying to think of everything. And I think what the Green Pioneer project showed, and I We presented to the United Nations IMO MEPC 3 weeks ago, and I believe it was our right to go there because we have done the hard work across our group. We've shown that it was possible. We've trained countless crew in numerous amounts of training, from advanced courses, firefighting courses, and so forth, and our own, you know, bespoke ammonia courses. This is the type of energy and input that we have to put in today, just so that those ships, esteemed colleagues in the previous panel, when those ships deliver in 2027, 2028, that the regulations are in place, the crews are in place, the training is in place, and also that we're all aligned because we can actually provide the fuel as well. So it's a massive undertaking that goes just beyond the technology of the ship to the whole ecosystem providing a new infrastructure for renewable fuels.
Thanks, Andrew. I think you have touched upon one point which I think I like it very much, in the sense that daring to be the first mover, you know, to try something new in the market and trying to build a business case thereafter, you know, to get the market moving and get everybody in the same path and in the same mindset to move to this energy transition period itself. So I think it's a very well done decisions made in terms of a fleet renewal or rather moving forward in the next few couple of years.
Yeah. Thank you.
So to touch on next is just now the first panel also mentioned about regulatory framework and policy. I think this is one thing that is pretty interesting and also critical to move the market itself. So maybe I would like to touch on with Dorothy,
yeah,
from the American P&I Club in terms of this energy transition period and the application of a new alternative fuels. How does the policies, regulations play an important role, and how does the P&I comes in to support in terms of this
right,
energy transition period time?
Yeah. Thank you for that. Yes, that's actually one of the overarching concerns that we have within the P&I regime on the liability side. So it's multi-level, okay, and I think everybody has touched on it even in the previous panel. So you've got aspects of safety, right, that have to be addressed. So obviously we do have safety procedures, let's say, for carrying a lot of these the fuels as cargo, but the same safety procedures don't necessarily fit within the context of using it as fuel. That goes also for bunkering practices. There's aspects in terms of, so from a P&I perspective, right, we deal with the liabilities, but that's within a certain parameter. We are the safety net, but the safety net is extended within specific parameters and regulatory frameworks, and the alternative fuels now don't necessarily fit within those international conventions. So we have to start working on, and the international group is actually actively working on researching and assessing the extent of the types of risk. So whenever you deal with first movers, right, that's really great, and we're trying to incentivize people for moving towards specific goals, but we also have to think about incentivizing also in order to make it within a framework where trade can actually work, where we can protect all stakeholders. And now, from a risk assessment perspective, of course, you can say, okay, the P&I clubs, they'll deal with it. But that's not really just the answer. The answer has to be where everybody has to come together, and we have to agree within what are the limits of liability. Do these alternative fuels actually fit? Do we understand all the types of risks? So, for example, when dealing with certain alternative fuels, we have pollution liability, right? Well, does it fit within that framework? And I don't think it exactly fits within that framework. Have we ever considered, or are we properly considering, for example, atmospheric contamination? And what extent does that go to? So we know that, for example, you know, and I'm not a technical expert in any way, but I know that, at least what I've read, that, let's say, ammonia clouds can extend much greater areas than, let's say, we've dealt with in terms of liability for damage that the ship can cause. And then, is the framework going to be fault-based, and are we going to go to the manufacturers that are creating some of the technology that are on the ships if the liability relates to fault or defect of the actual technology and perhaps not mistakes? And then we have the advancements of technology, which is outpacing the training of our seafarers on the ships, and we talked about that earlier, but ultimately we also have to deal with the safety of those people. So I think and then what about nuclear? You know, P&I liability actually excludes nuclear risks. So we're going to have to consider that from a liability perspective. So I think there's a lot of levels. The international group, thankfully, is very active. We have an alternative fuels working group that's working on this. We're cooperating with other stakeholders. But ultimately, all of us are going to have to deal with our own states, and we're going to have to deal with you know, the IMO is going to have to address this. Thankfully, I actually read recently that they've created like a risk categorization to deal with the different types of fuels to see where they fit within each regulatory regime, and that's going to be very important so that we understand what steps we have to take going forward. So I think that from a policy perspective, there's safety, there's international regulation, there's legal framework, and then there's even the rules themselves, which thankfully have been built to adapt to the needs of the shipowner and which ultimately protect all stakeholders.
Thank you, Dorothy. I think safety net is one of the key takeaways. That's what you mentioned. And, of course, on the second note is the incentive that how P&I can actually support the ship owners and the industry in moving or adopting the alternative fuels. Moving forward as well, right?
Yes, because I mean the overarching goal is to be inclusive, but that has to be done responsibly.
Thank you, Dorothy. Next on, I would like to touch on Federica. Yeah, with the marine adopting into the EU ETS systems, and the fuel EU is coming up as well. So, in terms of impact and initiative, what do you think in terms from 044? How would the business navigate this regulatory landscape? And how can it actually leverage on this initiative for businesses to drive in terms of opportunities?
Yes, as was mentioned in the panel before, and I said in my opening statement, the regulations are really here to help make sustainable fuels and future technology more price competitive. And we've seen two regulations now, CII and EU ETS, who work on pricing carbon as such, and so incentivizing really all those energy-saving devices, slow steaming, trying to make the ships in itself burning less fuel and thus saving CO2. With Fuel EU Maritime now starting next January, for the first time the fuel itself is being addressed. And there's an incentive to look at the well-to-wake emissions from each fuel type. So the whole production process of the fuel is also included in this regulation. And you have to meet certain greenhouse gas intensity targets. And these, for all the traditional marine fuels, those values are above the target that will be valid next year. So everyone who's operating ships is asked to include sustainable fuels in their fuel mix. And currently, as we've learned in the previous panel, mostly that's biofuel. And so we're seeing various new challenges coming to operating ships, very practical challenges that need to go along with the long-term strategies of new building, retrofits, and so on. And we think this places a heavy burden on the onshore teams, especially the chartering teams, but because all these regulations work with prices, taxes, and Fuel EU Maritime works with penalties quite a bit, also on the finance and accounting teams. So shipping companies have to manage a new complexity, and it won't stop with the European Union regulations. There's more regions of the world that are planning things, and I think shipping community is united in hoping that the IMO will hopefully replace that with global regulation. But each regulation tries to be very precise in how it incentivizes, and it tries to help manage the transition, and that leads to enormous complexities. Just to mention one example from Fuel EU Maritime that's coming up. So everyone is allowed to pool vessels to reach on average those greenhouse gas intensity targets. You are allowed to pool with other companies' vessels, so that's great. So people who invest in green ships, by the way, they can offer them for pooling, maybe even get extra revenue, so that's a great incentive. But it makes life so enormously complicated because you can only, or it's only worthwhile to pool ships that actually trade into Europe. So which business models really know in advance which ships will trade into Europe? So now chartering teams have to decide, do we have a set of ships that only trade into Europe and we pool those, or do we keep the global flexibility in our fleet? How do we deploy our ships, for example? That's just one of the many, many questions shipping companies have to ask themselves. And we truly believe that this is too much for a human brain to process and too much for a spreadsheet to manage, and that's why we're building software for it. So our software is trying to utilize the data our customers already have, which is the Noon Report data, which needs to improve in quality, which will have to include the well-to-wake emissions from biofuels, for example. So there's data challenges still, but we try to use these data that you already have and then build data models on top of that to help with the decision-making in daily chartering operations. And we help with splitting the bill. That's another point we heard in the previous panel. Can't be that only the owners who are being addressed by the regulation have to pay the full bill. They are allowed to forward the costs for EU ETS or the penalties from Fuel EU Maritime or the higher costs from biofuels to charterers who are allowed to forward is to cargo owners and so on and so forth. But that's a lot of bookkeeping. That's a lot of accounting. That's a lot of following the money, having a paper trail, understanding what's going on, all based on these original Noon Report data, by the way. And we're trying to also help with that paper trail, with the processes that are involved, help the finance and accounting chartering teams to manage it all, because those teams are limited in size, usually, and they're limited in experience with that. So we think software can really help.
Thanks, Federica. I think a very interesting point that you have mentioned with regards to the two policies that's going to come, initiatives that's going to come together, and how data-driven is going to be making sound decisions moving forward for the chartering for ship owners as well, using the reports that has been given to you and how they maintain the ratings of the ship's CII thereafter. So moving on the last topic or discussion for the panels, maybe I just drawing the discussions with the respective panelists. With the energy transitions and also the alternative fuels markets evolving, how can the industry actually do more, you know, to accelerate in this period of time? And in terms of, it can be in terms of capability development, economic technologies, or even regulations. And how does digitalization also help within this period of time? Maybe we start with Andrew, since you have signed an MOU yesterday and with MPA itself. Maybe you can share a little bit more insights on that.
I think one of the comments earlier, which I respect, is that we all wait for the international organisation to provide the solution for us. I can say locally here in Singapore for the project that we ran, we had like more than 100 people from different government agencies supporting us on that project. So there's an enormous amount that can be done at a local regional level as well to begin to shift the needle. We can't just let the IMO sort everything up there. There's an enormous amount of work that needs to be done down here as well. Yesterday, myself and I think 22 other organisations entered into an LOI with the Port Authority of Singapore, principally technology companies, class societies, engine manufacturers, and others as well. From the fuel side and technology side, basically to precipitate the advancement of training within Singapore. And again, it's a commercial enterprise. It's not a charity. We're all wanting to make money in this transition, with a commercial outcome. But I think this is where we need to focus a lot of attention at this time, because the technology, as we can make it ready, it's all well and good if you haven't got the people. And the people isn't just the crew. There's a much wider infrastructure of skills and resources that are required to manage renewable energies compared to traditional hydrocarbons across the insurance industry, across legal practices as well. So I think what we signed yesterday is a first step in Singapore for broadening that reach of training across the overall maritime space. And I think for myself, I think this is actually one of the main things that we're going to focus on over the next few years from a marine side, is to make sure that we've got the people to catch up as well. Yesterday, I think we took about 60, 70 people from institutes of higher learning onto the ship as well. And it takes, once they get on board, they get it. They understand what needs to be done. And we hope that those institutions will start working at it today.
Thanks, Andrew. How about Mark, from your perspective?
Yeah, I think the study that was released yesterday, the DNV Menin study, really showed Singapore as the leading city around shipping. And I think with that comes a certain level of responsibility to lead, as they are doing, very much the energy transition. And I think what I see here is the cooperation of all parties, and Andrew was just talking about it there. That's really, really important, that, and other cities should take a lead from that. Second thing is, for the first time in a long time, I listened to Arsenio speak yesterday, and I really felt the passion, the commitment, the potential, the drive, the energy that's needed from the IMO to make this work. And that voice needs to be heard. And I don't know if anybody noticed, but he didn't speak with notes. He just spoke directly. His level of understanding was complete. And he didn't downplay any of the complexities or any of the roles that any of us need to play in this. And he didn't champion anything either, which I think was articulated very well. And I think the third layer of complexity here is that you're seeing incomplete legislation being applied. And if you look at the EU ETA structure, we're all battling to try and understand that and get clarity and get legal understanding. And, you know, there are complete companies that have been started through this energy transition that are great opportunities for innovators to step up. But we really are an industry that is slow to innovate. It is true. I mean, that's just in our DNA. But I think sometimes we do need to just take a step back and see how far we've come. And when you look at the shipyards, what they've done with EEDI and what Arsenio was talking about the journey that we've actually been on this far, taking stock and taking some credit is also very, very important for us.
Thanks, Mark. How about Dorothy?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually comparing to a lot of other things we've gone through in this industry, we're doing a decent job. I think that from what I've read, there are more think tanks, more joint ventures, more R&D developments, more startups on this one topic, I think, than we've ever had in any other aspect of our industry. And I think we need to be very proud of that. There is 88 international non-governmental organizations with consultative status to the IMO. I think that there's more cooperation between private and public than we've ever had on this one topic as compared to others. So I think all things considered, we're doing a decent job from my perspective.
Thanks, Dorothy. Good to hear that. How about Danny yourself?
Yeah, I think the key that we've heard is partnership, and I think that's one thing that this industry has done very well together. There's just a huge collaboration together, and I think we need that to bring these new lower carbon value chains online. As I said before, I think we got to think about how we decarbonize now. So it could be operational measures on a vessel that reduces the carbon intensity, but it could be, as an oil company like ourselves, decarbonizing assets and producing those lower carbon fuels that we get today, selling and bringing new biofuels to the market to keep that scalable. Some of these other sort of methanol and ammonia value chains will take time to build to bring that scale. We've got to think about the safety. We've got to think about availability, scalability, price, and infrastructure. And I'll touch on the last two. I think price is the most important thing, right? We work in a margin business. That value goes somewhere in the value chain, or that cost goes somewhere in the value chain. It either sits with an end receiver, and the cost of moving product is going to increase, and we need to be mindful of that. To bring lower carbon products online, I think we need to make sure that we have or advocate for a price on carbon to level that playing field. But to build the value chain will take time, and infrastructure as well. Some ammonia infrastructure will take a wholesale change of shoreside infrastructure, shore tanks, bunkering infrastructure. This is going to run into billions and trillions of dollars. So there's a long path ahead of us, and I think by partnering and collaborating together is the way that we can achieve that.
Thanks, Danny. How about Federica? Go ahead and end off the session.
Yeah, it's tough to be the last one and to add to all these very valid points. Let me emphasize maybe the challenges for smaller shipping companies, because they haven't really had a voice yet, because mostly on those panels you find the bigger players. And I think it's super important that the bigger players are moving first and that there's a first mover alliance. But for many of the smaller shipping companies, this is really a tough transition because of all the things that have been said, and because, in my perception, shipping is an industry that loves to make business decisions in the here and now and very short term, kind of using the opportunities that arise and that can arise very unexpectedly. But this whole challenge requires long-term thinking, requires long-term strategies, because otherwise you can't make a sound decision on your investments and so on. And And I think there's some capability building or alliance forming or something like that needed for the smaller entities. We're trying to help with software. I think that's already an important step, but obviously the software can't take the really important decisions. It can help with them, but someone needs to take them, and I think capability needed building is needed and more cooperation to maybe make these decisions together.
Thanks, Federica. Unfortunately, time has flown by. We have come to the end of our sessions. I would like to thank all the panelists for your good insights, and thank you for your sharing. And I wish everybody a good day ahead, and please feel free to come to us after the session. Thank you. Thank you.